Hello there. Today is Wednesday, February 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, big changes in the Democratic race to take on President Trump, but it is a long way from over.
It is important that Iowa and Nevada have spoken, but look, we need to hear from Nevada and South Carolina and Super Tuesday states and beyond.
President Trump's Justice Department appears to help him put the Russia probe in the rearview mirror. Also ahead, the coronavirus now has been given an official name by the World Health Organization. It's all on today's International Edition. The first polls closed in New Hampshire Tuesday night in the first in the nation primary. The party hoped for results that would bring some clarity to a presidential nomination fight that's so far been marred by dysfunction and doubt. As Bernie Sanders predicted victory, former Mayor Pete Buttigieg hoped to seize the backing of his party's establishment with a strong finish. New Hampshire could begin culling the Democrats' 2020 class, which still features nearly a dozen candidates battling to take on President Trump in the fall. Tuesday's contest comes just 8 days after Iowa's caucuses, which injected chaos into the race and failed to report a clear winner. Joining us from New Hampshire is VOA correspondent Carolyn Presutti. Carolyn, while they will not announce an actual winner just yet, it is looking more clear about who did really well.
Lori, it looks like Bernie Sanders is going to pull out the New Hampshire primary, as he did 4 years ago. He took New Hampshire. He was rumored to be the leader all along, and certainly he is. I went to an event the night before last when every candidate was there, and I can only tell you the cheers and the chanting for Bernie were much louder than for the other candidates.
Definitely he's got the energy from his crowds. That's never been in question. Can he maintain it? Buttigieg, who really rose to a great position in Iowa, is also doing pretty well, it seems.
It's true. Pete Buttigieg is coming out full force. People are saying he is the moderate's answer to Bernie or Elizabeth Warren. So they're saying that he's getting those votes. And now that we had two people drop out, it'll be interesting to see where Michael Bennett's votes go and also Andrew Yang. Both of them dropped out as soon as they saw the early results and saw that they weren't polling well on those results. They decided to drop out of the race.
What about Amy Klobuchar? She seems to be also gaining a little traction.
She is certainly the darling lately because she has risen in the polls. After that debate, they said that she was such a star in the debate. That's when her polling went way up, and she's still riding that wave. So it'll be interesting to see how she does in the next contest, which is the Nevada caucus.
And really striking through all of this is who isn't even in the top three.
Vice President Joe Biden, right?
He was leading in all the polls for the last many, many months, and now it just looks like his campaign has fizzled out.
Well, if you remember in the debate, he made reference to the fact that he thought he was going to lose New Hampshire. When you put that thought into the audience, that is somewhat of a prediction come true. So I think he saw the writing on the wall and decided to put all his money, put all his effort into one of the next contests, which is South Carolina. But he went to South Carolina even before the polls closed here in New Hampshire, which angered a lot of his supporters here. So he didn't go to the next contest, which would be Nevada. He went to the contest after that, which is South Carolina. He said that people are more diverse there, and I think he'll get better votes there.
We have a long way to go still. We have many more states to vote still, and much of the country looks a little bit different than New Hampshire and Iowa.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have the caucus in Nevada, which is definitely different than a primary. And then we have South Carolina, and then what we call Super Tuesday, where 14 states vote all on the same night. So that will be huge, and that will certainly pare down the number here. We just have so many Democratic candidates. I was at a polling place earlier today, and I was talking to a woman who was walking out, and she said, oh my goodness, there were so many on the ballot. I'm lucky I found mine. And there were 33 Democratic candidates listed on that ballot, and 17 Republicans if you chose to vote Republican. So there are a lot of unknown names, lesser known names that are running for president. But as you and I already discussed, two have dropped out. And those weren't two. I mean, one was kind of an unknown, but Andrew Yang was on the debate stage. He got enough a percentage of votes to be there, but he did suspend his campaign. Andrew Yang ran on the platform that he was going to give every family $1,000.
The very first votes right at the strike of midnight in New Hampshire came from a very small town known for being the first people that vote in that state, Dixville Notch. Tell us just briefly what happened there.
Well, the tiny community has this tradition of opening its doors to voters at midnight. They only have five residents, that's it. So they cast their ballots quickly, and they immediately make the announcement. And guess who won? Somebody not even on the ballot, and that is Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York.
Wow.
He pulled it out, but then again, it's only three votes, but he did win that area. So he did win that precinct.
Interesting.
And then the next two were won by Amy Klobuchar. But again, those were three very tiny communities in New Hampshire.
So what was the last-minute push like for these candidates?
Oh, my gosh. They were out in full force because in New Hampshire, you have so many undeclared voters and undecided voters. Undeclared means they could, when they go to the polling location, they can either ask for a Republican or a Democratic ballot. And undecided is just how it sounds. They didn't make up their mind until they got to the polling place or maybe inside the polling booth. And so these candidates pulled out all the stops. We went to a Pete Buttigieg volunteer office. Guess who was there? Kevin Costner, two-time Academy Award winner. He
Wow.
was there to stump for Pete Buttigieg. He
Wow.
said that he heard him last year, and he liked what he said. He said he was clear, he was concise, and he just wanted to show his support. And then we were driving down the street, and there was a man that had maybe an 8.5 by 11 inch sign that he was carrying.
Mm-hmm.
It just said Bernie. And he was just walking down the sidewalk, and I thought, oh, my gosh,
wow.
I'm holding billboard just to get those. So they really do pull out all the stops, come up with these unique ideas, very creative, and also the celebrities out in full force.
All right, VOA correspondent Carolyn Frasutti joining us from first in the nation's primary, New Hampshire. Thanks for being with us. Well, there's been what appears to be a dramatic turn of events in how the United States Justice Department is operating. The four lawyers who prosecuted Roger Stone quit the case Tuesday after the Justice Department overruled them and said it would take the extraordinary step of lowering the amount of prison time it would seek for President Donald Trump's longtime ally and confidant. The day of upheaval began with a morning tweet from Trump that the Roger Stone case was a, quote, miscarriage of justice. He later told reporters he didn't speak to the Justice Department officials, though he said he could if he wanted to. Joining us live now from Minneapolis, Minnesota, is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, thanks as always for being with us.
It's great to be with you again.
So these resignations of these four U.S. longtime career U.S. attorneys are raising questions over whether the president earlier in the day, who blasted the original sentencing as horrible and unfair, had at least indirectly exerted his will on the Justice Department that he often views as an arm of the White House. How unprecedented is this, and is that what you see happened?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And I have to think about this in the broader sense. I've taught prosecutors and defense attorneys all over the world, okay? I mean, and in the former Soviet Union, so in the Republic of Georgia and the Southern Republics. I've been in Russia teaching all sorts of places around the world. And one of the things the U.S. government and the Justice Department really tried to train these various countries, including Ukraine, by the way, was that there needed to be a separation between the executive branch, the executive himself or herself, and what goes on with crime and what goes on with the criminal justice system, that there needed to be a separation so what you don't get is a manipulation of it by the executive themselves. That's when, in fact, that's one of the things that people were fighting about on the Ukrainian question. The real fear that we have right here is that we have a sitting president who basically is driving down his desire, his authority, to change what the Justice Department is doing in criminal investigations and potentially, in this case, in criminal sentencing. And that is unprecedented.
So how did they initially come up with the recommendations? There are specific guidelines for different offenses?
Yeah, absolutely. If we look at what happened here, after the investigation, the trial, and the conviction of Roger Stone, what we had him on was a series of things: obstruction, lying to investigators, lying to the Bureau, and trying to block the testimony of witnesses, a whole lot of things. And in fact, what the guidelines call for is anywhere from 15 to 21 months. That's the normal guideline. However, there was a memo that was written by the Justice Department, and what they did is they looked at very specific behavior of Roger Stone. For instance, one of the things that they did was Roger Stone had actually threatened to murder one of the witnesses and his dog. He also lied repeatedly to investigators even after he was indicted. In fact, other things he intended to do, he threatened, if you may recall this, he threatened the sitting judge, Judge Jackson in this case, and violated the gag order again and again and again. So what the Justice Department and these four very senior prosecutors did was they said, based upon what he was convicted of and based upon his behavior throughout this process, we believe that you should go upward dramatically. The real reason is because when you get somebody who does this, when they start manipulating the system, when they start trying to threaten witnesses, it undercuts the very foundation of what the Justice Department is trying to accomplish, what the penal system is all about. And so they said 7 to 9 years is absolutely appropriate. That's what they were trying to do, and that was their justification for it.
Have you ever seen, two-part question, have you ever, and this will, we'll just wrap it up, have you ever seen career prosecutors like this who made a decision, get overruled by a Justice Department, and then quit? And also, is it possible that the judge in the case will actually have the last word, or will this also influence that?
Well, technically, to get to the second question, the judge has the ability to override regardless. They can actually come in and say, this is what I'm going to do and this is why I'm going to do it. But it's likely they won't do it based upon what the Justice Department did when they came in and overrode this. Is this extraordinary? It is unprecedented. And when you take a look at what it is that these prosecutors, all four of them, by the way, and when they were overridden by somebody who was just assigned to the case, who used to work for the Attorney General Barr, and they were assigned on Tuesday, the date that the Justice Department overrode the original memo. It is extraordinary.
All right. We will see how this one unfolds. We always appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much. Legal expert, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, joining us live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Here are some of the stories we are following at VOAnews.com. Afghan leaders say the U.S. Taliban peace talks are making notable progress. China struggles to cope with surging numbers of infected coronavirus patients. Efforts are underway in the U.S. Senate to limit President Trump's Iran war powers. And the U.S. Defense Secretary says dissolving the Philippines military pact was a move in the wrong direction. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The 14-day coronavirus quarantine has ended for 195 Americans brought out of Wuhan on the first evacuation flight to the U.S. They are free to go home now, but the virus continues to spread. And this week, more than 400 scientists from around the world will be discussing the issue at a gathering in Geneva by the World Health Organization. They'll be looking at how to fast-track promising tests, drugs, and vaccines to help slow the outbreak of this new virus. Also Tuesday, the World Health Organization officially named the virus COVID-19, or coronavirus disease 19. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
A new name for the coronavirus that so far has killed more than 1,000 people and infected more than 43,000 worldwide, mostly in China.
Having a name matters to prevent the use of other names that can be inaccurate or stigmatizing.
It's called COVID-19. The World Health Organization says it selected a name that didn't refer to a specific geographical location, animal, an individual, or group of people. Meanwhile, as additional cases are confirmed in China and elsewhere, the global community is having a tough time keeping up with the virus. Though the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the situation is different in the United States.
13 confirmed cases, only 2 individuals acquired their infection here in the U.S. because they were essentially the partner of an individual who acquired the infection in Wuhan. Our aggressive measures with our travel and border strategy and our contact tracing and investigation, release of the lab test, support of the repatriation flights, has slowed the arrival of this virus.
On Tuesday, the first Americans who were put under quarantine 14 days ago after evacuation from Wuhan got some good news. Rear Admiral Dr. Nancy Knight.
All 195 of these evacuees have completed their quarantine period. They have completed their final health check this morning, which included their symptom check and their temperature check, and they have deemed to be safe to re-enter their communities. This is a huge celebration for all of us here at March Air Reserve Base.
But it was not all good news.
The first case detected in California in an individual who was part of another group that was repatriated from Wuhan, one of the subsequent charter flights. The individual is being cared for in California, and that person is now our 13th case that has occurred in the six different states.
Nearly 400 cases have been confirmed in two dozen countries and territories outside mainland China, with two deaths, one in Hong Kong and the other one in the Philippines. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
In Kenya's northeast Boni Forest, on the border with Somalia, schools that were closed for 5 years after Al-Shabaab terrorist attacks have reopened. But many children are still unable to attend, as few teachers are willing to work in the area. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Kiangwa, Kenya.
Kiangwa village is the gateway to Boni Forest, from where Al-Shabaab terrorists launched attacks in 2015 that forced area schools to close. Kiangwa Primary School was among five that shut their doors, forcing children to travel long distances, homeschool or get no education. But all the schools reopened for the first time in January for early childhood development classes.
We have greatly improved the security. We have also deployed teachers in those schools. We have a head teacher and a classroom teacher. We have ECD teachers in those schools. So the schools are running normally. We have also provided resources, books and everything.
But while Kiangwa Primary School resumed classes, authorities say the fear of Al-Shabaab attacks means few teachers are willing to return. So they had to cut the number of classes in half.
There were insecurities in our school. We enhanced security, but we don't have enough teachers. There's only one teacher per so many students.
Parents in this remote and poor area of Kenya worry that if not enough teachers are found, their children's education will come to a halt. Zainab Bakari's son should have started grade 8 this semester.
Here we've only got school up to 4th grade. I don't have the fare to send him out. It's my loss. I am at a loss.
Farid Sadiq is one of only two teachers at the school.
We feel there's something to be done to the community, because we were trained as teachers and we were trained to work anywhere in the public.
Families can only hope the improved security will attract more teachers so all the children can get back to school after such a long break. Muhammad Yusuf for VOA News, Kiangwa, Kenya.
The United Nations said in Geneva Tuesday nearly 700,000 Syrian civilians have been displaced since the beginning of a government offensive in Idlib province in northwestern Syria. Syrian government forces backed by Russian airstrikes are pounding areas in Idlib and Aleppo as they try to seize the final rebel strongholds. Turkey backs the rebels but has retreated militarily, leaving thousands of civilians trapped between the two sides. Jens Laerke is the spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
In just little more than 10 weeks from the 1st of December till today, nearly 700,000 people have been forcibly displaced in Idlib and surrounding areas in northwest Syria, most of them women and children.
Another 280,000 people could be forced to flee from the urban centers, including the city of Idlib, which is crammed with people fleeing fighting in other parts of the country. Eric says there has never been such a rapid displacement of people in Syria since the war began.
This is, from our initial analysis, the largest number of people displaced in a single period since the Syrian crisis began almost 9 years ago. So the fastest growing displacement we have ever seen in the country.
Nearly one-third of Syria's population of 5.5 million people are living as refugees in the region, and another 6 million internally displaced. Civilians are struggling to find shelter with mosques and makeshift camps full. Andrei Mukhechich is the spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency.
A critical need is shelter, compounded by the harsh winter conditions. Many have had to flee already several times, leaving behind possessions and with limited places for them to stay.
He says the impact of winter storm Karim, which has pounded Lebanon and Syria over the past few days, has made survival even more difficult.
As you know, storm Karim has hit this region about 2 days ago. Today there is snow, rain, and wind, and it feels like below zero in terms of the temperatures.
Meanwhile, Tuesday, Syrian government warplanes struck Idlib's center just hours after Turkish forces downed one of Syria's Russian-made utility helicopters. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. The new report claims asylum-seeking women fleeing persecution and sexual violence are often made destitute in Britain, living in absolute poverty without access to housing, financial support, or the right to work. Martha Vanderwolf reports.
The report by the non-governmental organization Women for Refugee Women says of the asylum-seeking women becoming destitute in Britain, three-quarters ended up in that situation after their asylum claim was rejected. The group researched how asylum-seeking women survive in Britain after being made destitute. The report states they are hungry, homeless, and some deal with mental health issues. A third of the women surveyed said they were raped or sexually abused in their country of origin, and for many, it happened again when they became destitute in Britain. Women for Refugee Women's Priscilla Dudja headed the research. She says destitute women suffer in ways different from men.
For example, the prevalence of sexual violence, being caught in abusive relationships, the struggles that women go through to access period products like pads and tampons. And there was a sense among the women in our network that although there's been some really good research on asylum and migrant destitution more generally, the specific experiences of refugee women aren't properly understood.
Christina, not her real name, is among 16% of women that the NGO report says are persecuted for their sexuality. Coming from Cameroon, a country with laws against homosexuality, she faced abuse and ostracism by both her family and the community when people found out she was a lesbian. She came to Britain as a student, looking for safety. After completing a master's degree in business, she applied for asylum as she still faces violence at home. But now, 10 months later, there has been no update on her asylum request. The insecurity of her status is making her feel vulnerable once again.
I have a bachelor's degree, I have an MBA, but I can't do anything with it. So all of that makes you stressful and you're just wasting time, you know. You can't do anything the whole day. There's nothing you can do. You can't work. Your finances are so limited. You can't go anywhere. So it's so stressful, honestly. It's so stressful. Physically, I'm more safe, but mentally, I'm not safe.
Christina has been homeless at times and struggles to survive on the $47 she gets a week in government welfare money. Christina was placed in housing outside of London and depends on charities providing transport money to attend gatherings in the capital where she can connect with other asylum-seeking women. Loneliness is prevalent among the respondents of the research. Heike Langbein works with various charities to counsel asylum-seeking women, including those whose claim has been rejected and who have nowhere to return. Langbein says one of the main challenges are to get those destitute women back into the system so that they can get access to support.
There's a lack of good quality legal advice. A lot of the legal aid solicitors are completely overstretched and wouldn't really be taking on fresh claims. When women are destitute and are struggling to meet their day-to-day living needs, when they're really unwell, have mental health issues or other physical health conditions, it's very difficult for them as well to focus on getting the evidence together to lodge a fresh claim.
The research was conducted in 4 English cities and 2 cities in Wales. 106 women were interviewed from 29 countries, with a quarter coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are no statistics available on the total number of asylum seekers living in destitute in Britain. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Janet Jackson is hitting the road, the superstar announcing a world tour in 2020 for the upcoming release of her album, Black Diamond. The tour will kick off in Miami in June and include 34 cities in North America. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today. But you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.